Anywhere with Jesus is my home, sweet home. Those words are easy to sing, but I can tell you when you're in Baghdad, they're a lot harder to live. Let's see, I got to get this going again now. While it's coming up here, I want to thank you for being here tonight, not necessarily to hear me speak, but thank you for being here to worship God today, this evening, especially on Mother's Day and busy schedules. It's an encouragement to me every time I get to come to service to see all of you come out and want to worship God and to be here, and it encourages me that you're here. I want to thank the elders for the opportunity to speak. I asked Doug if I could give a lesson on the things that I saw in Baghdad and some of the lessons that I learned there a couple of weeks ago for a couple of reasons. One, I wanted to share with you as my brothers and sisters in Christ some of the things that I saw over there and some of the lessons that I learned from a Christian's perspective. But also, I think as Americans, you deserve to hear of what's going on over there and how our money, our taxpayer money, is being spent and the things that our soldiers are doing in the name of the U.S. I think that we owe that to you. So can a Christian learn something in Baghdad? That's the question that I pose tonight, and I think as I get to the end of this lesson that you'll see that the answer is yes. Definitely can. Okay, looks like I'm all up and ready to go. All right, so I'd like to cover three things. First, I'd like to start with the timeline of the Iraq War, specifically because we went to war with Iraq in 2003, and some of the younger members of the congregation may have only been about 5 or 6 years old then, so they probably don't remember a whole lot about that. So I'd like to go through that timeline. Second, I'd like to show you some pictures, scenes from my deployment, some of the things that I saw, some of the things that I got to do, and then finally I'll end with the lessons learned in Baghdad. In Baghdad. Now, my wife told me that I will not be late, and so I may skip quickly through some of the pictures if I'm getting behind. Of course, you always have to give a disclaimer. This presentation may cause drowsiness or irritability. I hope not. But I did want to say that I don't aim to make any political statements or things that I think are right or wrong that the U.S. government did. I'm not here to do that. What I want to tell you is about the situation that I saw there and how we got there and some of the things it meant to me, not necessarily anything political. All right, like I said, first thing I'd like to cover is Iraq timeline. As I left the U.S., I found myself asking, why am I here? Why am I going to Iraq? What are we still doing here? I thought the war ended. These are all questions going through my mind, so I wanted to talk to you about what we're doing there now as opposed to what we started out doing in 2003. So March of 2003, the U.S. invaded Iraq to topple the Saddam Hussein regime. It took about 2 months. May of 2003, U.S. declares victory. We are in Baghdad. The Saddam Hussein regime had been ended, and all major combat operations end. So that seems kind of weird. May of 2003, the war was over after basically 2 months. It took about another 6 months to capture Saddam Hussein, who had escaped to the north, and ironically, had went to the town of Tikrit, Iraq, which was exactly where I was deploying to. So as I thought about that, it was kind of odd. He was actually captured, for some of the older ones who remember seeing on TV, in a hole. He was living underground in a hole in the city of Tikrit, Iraq. In June of 2004, the interim Iraq government takes over, had formed an interim Iraq government and a new government, and they took over some control of Iraq from the coalition who was in control in Baghdad at that time. In January 2005, about 6 months later there, the Iraq holds its first democratic election and elects their Council of Representatives, which is a lot like our Congress, to form their government. By May of 2006, Prime Minister Maliki, who was elected as the Prime Minister of Iraq in the January 2005 elections, predicts that Iraq would be able to take over security by the end of 2007. Now, as we know, that didn't happen, but he felt like that they would have enough trained forces by then that they could take over security and Iraq could hand it back over to them. In December of 2006, Saddam Hussein was executed after a trial. As you may remember, it was kind of a botched thing because it was televised, or it was somehow somebody recorded it with a cell phone camera, and it got it on the internet showing him being hanged, and was extremely offensive to the Arabic culture, and I think caused a lot of problems, which may have not happened otherwise. But also, I think those who were holding on that maybe Saddam would take power again realized that he wasn't going to be taking power again. And so things then kind of got desperate in Iraq. And 2006, 2007, 2008 were some of the deadliest years. Most U.S. forces lost their lives during that time frame. In January 2007, the U.S. surged 30,000 troops because the situation was bad. The president felt that we needed more troops there, hoped that they would only have to stay about 18 months, if you remember, and that we could get the security situation under control and they could come back home. Iraq calls for a withdrawal in May of 2007, a withdrawal timetable. So Iraq government was saying, we'd like to know when it is exactly you're leaving and that you are leaving at some time. So they're wanting to see this timetable. U.S. and Iraq agreed to a timetable to sign the formal agreement in November of 2008 saying that all U.S. forces would be out of Iraq by the end of 2011, which is currently what we're shooting for now. So the second Iraq election is held in January of the next year. In February of 2009, President Obama announced that all combat troops would be out of Iraq by August 2010. And if you remember last fall when the news showed that all the U.S. combat troops left Iraq. Now, that's sort of a misnomer because only the forces who were there to specifically conduct combat left. And the advise and the train and help the Iraq continue to stand up, all of those troops still left. Left about 50,000 troops still in Iraq at the end of August 2010. U.S. begins to withdraw from Iraq cities in June of 2009, meaning that the forces had been out with all Iraqi forces, and at the June of 2009, all the forces drew back to bases. So all U.S. forces in country were on a base, whether that be an Air Force base or an Army base, whatever, the Iraqi bases, but all U.S. forces were on those bases. They weren't out in the Iraq cities anymore. And then March of last year, Iraq holds their third elections, which were somewhat contentious, and took about 6 months to form their government. After those elections, because some of the Iraqis saw that they weren't fair elections, if you remember that in the news. And then last August, 31 August last year, all U.S. combat troops left Iraq, leaving, as I said, about 30,000 troops in country. That's what I was a member of, the Iraq Advise and Train and Assist mission. Those forces, as well as forces there to protect the advising and training forces, were the only forces left in Iraq. So that's what I was going to partake, to be a part of, was helping Iraq train and advise their security forces, all their military. So what's this place called Iraq? I found myself asking that as I was leaving the country. What is this place, Iraq? Well, I want to show you a map about how big it is. It's actually not that large of a country when you compare it to the size of the United States. Here are some of the features of Iraq. A couple of things I wanted to point out. Baghdad in the middle, as you probably know. The Tigris and Euphrates rivers running through the middle of the country. You see here, it's broke up into provinces, which you heard a lot about in the news. Big cities being Al-Basra, Baghdad, and then the north, Erbil and Mosul, two of the biggest cities up there. Those are some of the cities that you hear about in the news quite a bit. All right, so my journey begins. Specifically, I put 23 August, which is when I left Montgomery, because that was my birthday. Not a great birthday present, but I was going to New Jersey to do some training. Most U.S. forces, before they leave, go through some sort of training, usually about 4 to 6 weeks before they leave the country. And I was going to an air advisor course up in New Jersey. So I flew to Atlanta, then I flew to Philadelphia. I was in New Jersey for about a month. Then I flew back to Norfolk, Virginia, which is where I was going to leave the country, but I had about 3 days. So if you may remember that I came back to Montgomery for the weekend to see my family one last time before I flew out, and I flew back to Norfolk on a Monday and got ready to leave on Tuesday, just showing you I was flying all over the country. So I had numerous frequent flyer miles before I ever even left the country. Okay, so on the 21st of September, I left Norfolk. The route, I just kind of wanted to show you the route that most U.S. forces fly through. You fly through Iceland, stop there in Iceland to refuel the aircraft, and then from there flew to Leipzig, Germany. Most forces either fly through Leipzig or Ramstein and into Italy, or as I did, just fly straight into Al Udeid, Qatar. And you're at Al Udeid, Qatar, usually 24 to 48 hours to get your gear, get your ammo in country. because you don't fly over there with ammo. You collect your ammo once you get to Qatar. So while I was on the ground in Qatar, some of the pictures here, staying in the tents, the tent city here, which there's, I think, about 100 of these tents. I stayed in building tent number 52. I don't know how well you can see that. You can't see that picture real well. I've got another one later. These are just bunks that you see here. There's about 50 bunk beds per tent, so you're kind of stuffed in there. Not the best night's sleep. But you've been on an aircraft for about 24 to 36 hours between that and the airport, so you're pretty tired, so you sleep some. I wanted to show you here, this is the dining hall, so you don't have a whole lot to do for 48 hours, and all the food is free, and you just go in and eat. So I had to find myself away from that because they serve self-serve ice cream, and I would have just been eating that too much. So, all right, so after 48 hours on the ground in Qatar, I flew into Balad, which is one of the main U.S. bases left in Iraq with all U.S. forces on the base in Balad. Stayed at Balad for a day before I flew on in. I found these signs comic of the All-American Billeting Office. Like, who else is going to be on our base? Then another tent, just showing the tents here that you stay in. I think this bunk bed picture is a little better. Yeah, so you get crammed in there. And I always seem to get in a bunk with a guy who's got a cold. So he coughs the whole night. I don't know why. Every tent I stayed in, there had to be some guy in there with a cold. This is a typical scene in Iraq. As you might know, as you might guess, desert with usually some trees that look like they're dying. Okay, so after I was there for a day, I flew from Balad up to Tikrit, which was, as I mentioned before, where I was at to be a college advisor. And flying from, it was only a short flight, about 30 minutes, but it was about 130 degrees in the aircraft, and we were crammed in there with all that extra gear on. So once we got up to altitude and it cooled down, everyone fell asleep. So I took a picture of everyone sleeping, which as soon as it flashed, I saw a lot of people like, why are you taking pictures of us? All right, and this was my home sweet home while in Tikrit. Just a little trailer here. They called them CHUs, containerized housing units, CHUs. We shared a bathroom in the middle, and then on each side was a room that you got, which is pretty much a bed and a desk. This particular one did have a sink, so I was very, very happy that I had a sink. At least you could shave and brush your teeth in the morning without having to go share a bathroom. This is where I worked at the Expeditionary Mission Advisory Group, which was, they had two missions. One was to transition the bases back over to Iraqis, which you say just give it back to them. And it's not quite that simple because there's a lot of U.S. equipment on that base, and we have to sign that over saying that we gave it to them because it's more expensive to bring it back to the U.S. than it is just to give it to the Iraqis. So what's one of the missions of the group? The other mission was the mission that I was part of was to advise the Air Force College, which is the Iraqi U.S. Air Force Academy equivalent. So training the Iraqi military members on the Air Force military members on being an officer, that sort of thing. And I was there to help them, help their instructors with their curriculum and building their course. So that's what I was there to do. This, I'm just showing in this picture the water. There was no running water except for the sink in the bathroom that you saw before. So everything was water bottle. And I saw everything from people washing a car with water bottles to dumping it over their head to cleaning off the floor in their office with water bottles. So there was water everywhere. And then we were also helping, you see the canister there, we were helping the Iraqis try to get the concept of recycling. All their stuff, because they just kind of threw it everywhere. This is their dining hall, their dining facility there for the officers that were going to school at the Air Force College. And I think that says in Arabic, dining hall or officer's mess, because it was also the officer's dining facility. And this is their Air Force College, one building. They had about 150 cadets going to school here, and not the best looking building. They were kind of trying to fix it up some. But the next picture shows you the contrast between this is the Air Force or the Air Force College for the Iraqi Air Force, and this is the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Stark difference between the two. This is the gentleman in the middle of the picture here. Right here is Lieutenant General Anwar. He is the commander of the Iraqi Air Force, the lead commander, and he was picking out uniforms at this particular meeting. He was picking out uniforms that the cadets were going to wear when they were going to college there. But also I wanted to show you this picture. At every gathering that I ever went to, they always served orange juice, hot Sprite, and fresh fruit and baklava. I don't know why they thought Americans liked hot Sprite and hot orange juice, but they always served that. So I usually took the water. All right, I was there for about 1 month, and then I moved down to Baghdad because they had too many advisors up there at the college because the Iraqis changed the way that they were doing business. So they moved me down to Baghdad. So this is just a picture of Baghdad. The city's about 5 million people, so it's a pretty good-sized city. And this is just showing the different neighborhoods around Baghdad. And then specifically, I wanted to call your attention to the Saddam International Airport, which is now renamed the Baghdad International Airport. But this is where I was working, where the U.S. forces are stationed now in the Baghdad area, there at the airport. This just shows the layout of the airport that you saw on the previous map there, and the different camps that you might have heard in the news and stuff when they talk about the different forces there. Camp Liberty, Victory, and Slayer, and then I was over here on Sather Air Base, which Sather Air Base ran the military airlift in and out of Baghdad Airport. And then Hawk Base is where the Iraqi Air Force headquarters were, which was where I went to advise the Iraqi Air Force on standing up all their operations. But if you probably remember hearing in the news Route Iris, which was one of the most dangerous routes in 2005 and 2006, and where most of the U.S. Service members lost their lives in Iraq on Route Iris. Car bombings and suicide attacks and all that happened on Route Irish, very dangerous and much safer now because there's so many patrols on that. But the two places in Baghdad where U.S. service members could serve were either on the base here, one of these bases, or over in their international zone, which is also where the embassy is at and all that sort of thing that you have in a big city of your country, kind of like our Washington, D.C. Their embassies and all that are in the international zone. So this is where I lived, in the containerized housing units, the CHUs, in Baghdad. I put my Purdue sticker on my door there to show my Purdue pride. This is the inside of one of the units there. Some people had roommates where they had bunks there. Most of the officers didn't have to have a roommate, so I didn't have to have a roommate, which when you're living in a 12 by 12 and you're working 12 hours a day, you certainly don't want a roommate. This was a latrine. The only bad part about going to Baghdad was I didn't have a bathroom in my room. So anytime you wanted to go to the bathroom, I had to walk about 200 yards to the bathroom, which when you get up in the night and you have to go to the bathroom is really annoying. This was the walk to the dining facility, walking to where you see the guy going there. It's about a quarter mile, and I'm just showing you out in the open there behind the concrete's what we call T-walls, which are there to protect all the housing areas. And then everything was behind a T-wall, so all you saw was signs, and then you had to go behind the T-wall. You go to sick call or get an immunization. The post office where I went to mail things back to our villa and the kids, and little postcards and things that I had. And the lodging office, which I found to be quite comical. If you note, it's called the Palm Tree Resort. I did not see any palm trees in Baghdad, nor did this seem like a resort. So I thought that was sort of a misnomer. And we did have some facilities where, recreation facilities, where if, when we're off duty, we could go shoot some basketball. And then this basketball court also had some phones in there, which was kind of an odd combination. If you're playing basketball, you're trying to talk on the phone. But these are free internet phones where you could call back to the States to talk to your family. This particular picture, I wanted to show two things. One, the building here that you see the U.S. flag in front of is the building that I worked in with the wing. And then I also want to point out in this picture that the rain was welcome when it came finally. I got there in September and it didn't rain the first time till January. And it was hot and dry. And so you're like, if it could just rain. And then I realized there's no drainage system. So as soon as it rains, it all stands. So everything was a muddy mess. I was like, wow, maybe this wasn't the best thing. Maybe the dry was better. This is inside the office building where I worked with the A2 directorate, which is the intelligence directorate. This was on top of Saddam Hussein's palace. He called the Victory of America Palace. And he named this palace the Victory of America Palace because he thought that when he was not killed in 1991 during the Gulf War, that he had won because we didn't kill him. So he said that he had a victory over America and started building this palace in the early 90s. And it wasn't quite finished. No one was actually in it, so it wasn't really a legitimate target, because no one was there. What's the point in bombing it? But because it was called Victory over America Palace, we went ahead and dropped some bombs on it. And so it had some big holes in the side of it. But this particular picture was taken on Veterans Day, and they allowed us to climb up on top and fly an American flag on Veterans Day over the Victory over America Palace. So that was quite an interesting memory. My job in Baghdad was to help the Iraqis with this particular aircraft and a couple others that they had on setting up how to. It has cameras on board to take video and pictures, and then it downlinks those to a ground station where they can take pictures. And so I was helping them learn how to use these aircraft that the U.S. had bought for them. You see the Iraqi flag there. This is me getting ready to go on one of the missions where we're going to fly down to a ground station. I'm going to meet up with some of the lieutenants that work the ground station and explain to them how to use the equipment that we had given them and how they can use it to fight against terrorists, you know, to find them, track them down, pass the information off to forces on the ground. So this is what you see inside the aircraft. On the left-hand side here is the, you see the map where it shows where the aircraft is looking down on the ground. And in the right-hand screen, you see what the camera is seeing on the ground. So the first mission, I got to fly down to Basra, and there's their little ground station, which is really just a trailer with an antenna on top of it, which is receiving the video from the aircraft. And I got to meet up with these two gentlemen there, two Iraqi lieutenants, and we're all laughing because I found out that they were both engineers. I said I was engineer, and when the guy got ready to take the picture, I said we're all three engineers. Geeky, and we probably couldn't get a girl to date us in high school. So they thought that was really funny. The next mission I got to fly on was down to Al-Kut, which is another ground station. It was kind of a more remote location. And then I met up with these gentlemen, some more Iraqi lieutenants that worked at Al-Kut ground station. And then I also got to fly up to Kirkuk to the north. And I meet, there's one lieutenant up there that ran this ground station, Lieutenant Ali. And this is here. The picture on the left is him taking notes of what we had done and what we had taught him so he could tell his boss, because he said he was going to get in trouble from his boss if he didn't have a good report on what exactly we did. So I thought that was kind of funny. This gentleman here is an Iraqi Air Force lieutenant colonel. He is the squadron commander over all the aircraft. So he was having a dinner over on the base that he works on. This is some Iraqi food. How will that come out? Yeah. Iraqi food was always interesting. What most of us did was drink a lot of Coke before and after, so we have lots of acid in there to help eat up anything that they didn't cook out. So it was the standard practice to drink a lot of Coke when you're going to eat Iraqi food. And unfortunately, they wanted to give us Sprite, so we always brought our own Cokes. These are two of the interpreters that we had. The one interpreter that I work mostly with on the right, her name's Sarapi. She is from Egypt originally, but she moved to the United States. She's actually a United States citizen. And she was our interpreter that we worked with most of the time when we were there. She was kind of our mom of the office, so it was kind of interesting to work with her. This is a picture of the Al-Fa Palace, which is where Saddam used to be when he was close there to the Saddam, or to the Baghdad airport, and where the U.S. commanding general in charge of all the Iraq forces, or the U.S. forces in Iraq, this is where that general works at. That's just me standing in front of the Al-Fa Palace there. I don't know if you can see me in this picture. I took this picture for scale. I'm standing down right here. So I just wanted to show how tall. That's actually three floors, and this chandelier is just monstrous. It's huge. As you can see here, a picture taken down. This is right before I left, they did a change of command for the general that I was working for that in charge of all the U.S. Air Forces that were there. And we're doing a change of command ceremony. This is me sitting in Saddam's chair that Yasser Arafat gave him. It was quite interesting that I was sitting here, and this Quran, this is a couple verses from the Quran here. And this inscription over on the wall here said that Yasser Arafat gave Saddam this chair and said it was a gift. And the inscription above it basically says something to the effect that the Muslims will have a victory over the Christians. So I thought it was kind of ironic that I was sitting in his chair. All right, let me sum up with some lessons learned, and I see I'm almost out of time now. I think biggest lessons I learned was worshiping God with other Christians as a blessing. The verses here, Matthew 18, 19, 20, say, where two or three of you gathered together, I'm there with you. And I really felt that in Baghdad. I didn't have really a place to worship. I tried to find some other members of the Church of Christ or Christians that wanted to get together. Most of them wanted to worship at the chapel, which I didn't really feel comfortable doing. They had a praise band and all this stuff, and it seemed more like a concert to me. So this was my church while I was there. So I would use my computer, and I would download some of the lessons from the website, from the Dalrader website, and I heard Brother Terry Edwards give a lesson over the internet, and I heard Will, and I heard Michael, and I heard Doug. So I got to listen to a lot of sermons, and I got some communion supplies, and I just had to do my own worship service by myself. So I definitely appreciated worshiping with other Christians, and that's one of the things I missed most while in Baghdad, is getting to worship together. Another thing I learned was that our Walmarts are bigger than their villages, which is sad. Our super Walmarts are bigger, and several of the Iraqis that I worked with had an opportunity to come back to the U.S., and one of the biggest things on their agenda was to go to a Walmart. When I asked them, what's the big deal about a Walmart? They said, I can't believe there's one building that you can go in and get everything you need. They thought that was the neatest thing. The next thing I learned was that we overlook New Testament freedoms. I say this specifically because the verses here, Mark 12, 28 through 31, are when Jesus is telling, has been questioned and says the two commandments are the greatest are love the Lord your God and love your neighbor. And all the commandments are summed up in those. And when I looked at the Muslims and all the things that they had to do, it just reminded me of the Israelites and all those things they had to do to worship God. And we have freedom that Jesus gave us just to love others and to worship the way that's been laid out and not have to do five prayers a day and fast for a month and make sure you do the right things during Ramadan and make sure to travel to Mecca if you can and just on and on and on. It was just really sad to think of all these rules that they have put on themselves. Another thing I learned was that being born in the USA is a gift from God. When I looked at, I had an opportunity to go over to the Iraqi Boy Scouts, and here's one of the Iraqi Boy Scouts that I got to work with. He was so proud of his mask that he made. He made that mask and actually spent more time on it, which is why he was the last kid there, because he spent a lot of time on his. But when I saw these Iraqi children, I thought, wow, it's just a gift that we're born in the U.S. These children didn't get to choose where they were born. They were born into this country, Iraq, and that's where they've got to grow up. And we get to grow up here and have all the freedoms and luxuries that we do just simply because we were born here. This picture is showing some of the candy that I was handing out, some of the candy and things that the congregation actually sent me. And after Christmas, we had so many candies and goodies. And I said, we cannot eat all this. This is crazy. So I gathered a big bunch of stuff up and took it over there. I was specifically holding the box up because the two people that I went with said, do not let the kids get in the box. They will rip it out of your hands. They go at it like crazy because they don't know when they're going to get candy again. So they want to get all the candy they can. So they were stuffing pockets and pulling out candy and stuffing it all in. And this is kind of where I had a little bit left and they pulled the box out of my hand. They were pulling the box out of my hand at this point, trying to get all the candy, which was kind of sad. And finally, we take living secure for granted. That was one of the biggest things I learned over there. I talked to an Iraqi general one time, and they were having a big ceremony, and they were getting this new helicopter system. And I said, don't you want to go up to Taji and Air Base and be a part of that? And he said, no, I don't want to leave Baghdad. And I said, well, why not? And he said, I'll probably get blown up. And I was like, wow, I'd never even thought of that before. You know, to think that you can't even move around without possibly getting blown up. And all the Iraqi Air Force members that came to work where I was living behind the protective walls, they would check their cars for bombs in the morning, and they would make sure they took different routes to make sure they could get there safely. And I thought, none of us check our cars to make sure there's not a bomb underneath it. And we don't have to alter our route to make sure that we don't get shot or killed on the way to work. Or on the way to wherever we're going. And I don't know when I was leaving there how secure Baghdad's going to be whenever we leave. But I know that in order for it to get there, that there's just going to have to be forgiveness between all the different sects, in the religious sects in Iraq. I don't know how else to get around it than that, because there's so much killing and death that has went on that if you're looking for revenge, it's never going to end. This specific passage here is about, in Matthew, is about the servant, the unforgiving servant, who his master forgives him, and then he goes out and he doesn't forgive his servant, and he's chastised by his master because of that. But it reminded me when I was there, and I was looking at the almost a civil war between that kind of developed between the Sunni and the Shia. And how that's all going to play out whenever we leave. And it reminded me that we were once a fractured nation like that. We were once a nation that went to war with each other. And I had a little passage here that I read in a daily bread that I get. And I wanted to read that to you because on Mother's Day it was really interesting to me, where our country was at the end of the Civil War. When the U.S. Civil War ended in 1865, more than 500,000 soldiers lay dead. The economy was shattered, and people remained deeply divided politically. The observance of Mother's Day in the United States began with two women's efforts for peace and reconciliation during this time of anguish. In 1870, Julie Ward Howe called for an International Mother's Day on which women would unite in opposing war in all its forms. A few years later, Anna Reeves Jarvis began her annual Mother's Friendship Day in an effort to reunite families and neighbors alienated by the war. There's always great suffering when friends and family are fractured and unwilling to forgive. The gospel of Jesus Christ brings the promise of peace and reconciliation with God and with each other. When Peter asked Jesus, "How often should we forgive a brother who sinned against him?" the Lord surprised everyone with his answer of 70 times 7. Then he told an unforgettable story about a servant who had received forgiveness and failed to pass it on. As God freely forgives us, so he requires that we extend what we have received to others. And I really think that's, underneath it all, the only thing that can bring peace and security to Iraq is that the people of Iraq have to look past all the death and destruction and have to forgive neighbors that they live by who may see things differently than they do. Finally, I wanted to say that the biggest lesson that I saw in Iraq that I learned was that we have peace in Jesus Christ. And because the Islam has such a hold on that country, there's no peace that can come to them. This, when Jesus said to us, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I'll give you rest," is a promise that Jesus made to us, but they don't have that promise. And it was really sad. It was really sad to think that, because of the Muslim religion and what that takes away from them. But if you have something on your heart, if you're burdened, you can come to Jesus and you can get rest. You can give that to him, you can get rid of that burden, and you can feel much freer because of that. But if you need to come forward tonight and take on Jesus and put Jesus at the center of your life so that you do have this promise, we offer the invitation now to you.